this episode of Tennessee Pro with Reading How. I'm your host, Felicia Baxter. I'm hopeful that this is going to be allowable or a pattern for me that I will be able to broadcast with some consistency, at least on Sundays. And I hope to bring to you a couple of, you know, things I've noticed over the weekend or over this past week. I'm still pumped from my voting experience. I voted early and in person here in Tennessee, and I've never been so proud of myself and others. I watched this week a very disturbing special on A&E about child brides, and I'm also just finishing watching Queen's Gambit, which is a limited series on Netflix. It's actually a pretty good flick. A little disturbing. I was just struck by the loneliness of the main character, Elizabeth. I'm reading this week's, I used the book review and the life portion of the Times Free Press, but completely underwhelmed about the reporting this week. But I was turned on to, I will be getting this month's issue of Vogue, 312 pages dedicated in propping up the talented people of color. For once, you would say it's kind of late, and I think Andre Talley, former editor at Vogue, he called it when he published his book towards the beginning of this year. I had a great eat this morning or this afternoon. Greens, the best chicken I believe on the planet, is fresh Publix fried chicken, and some cornbread with Gouda mac and cheese. Was reflecting on drinking Uncle Nearest of bourbon and why I was kind of boycotting Basil Hayden's because it was from Kentucky. And I'm writing about a kit house on Mission Ridge that I've fallen in love with and what all that means. And as always, I thank you for joining me, and I hope you enjoy this episode just as much as I've enjoyed creating it. When I cast my ballot the second day of early voting here in Tennessee, what initially floored me was how many other people were thinking the same thing as I was. We all showed up to the Hamilton County electorate early because we wanted to get in as early as we wanted, as we could, because the other polling station for a county of this considerable size only having 4 early voting stations, this was the only one that actually opened at 8 o'clock. My plan was to get out there early because I knew I was going to have to wait. If there was any shenanigans, it would prolong it. However, I also was prepared in advance. I bought my director's chair, I had coffee, and I had water, I had my video games, and I had my book to write. Didn't need any of that, except for my chair, which I kept moving forward, because it actually moved pretty briskly. One of the things that I can say is, what weighed heavily on my mind is other people that I'm praying that they would get the opportunity to vote. Because we do have to vote like our lives depend on it. We got several hundreds of thousands of people, 220 at today's count, another 80,000 people that are sick. Just got or tested positive yesterday. And then we got reports that from Meadows, the chief of staff at the White House, that they don't have control of this pandemic. Well, no shit, y'all don't have control of the pandemic. We've known that since January. So you really, we are really here on our own. You can't trust the police because they may want to kill you because they get the wrong person and they are allowed to get it wrong and nothing happens to them. You got a jackass in charge in the White House that has been playing the fool, lining his pockets, not paying his bills, leaving us vulnerable to this hunter of a virus. And now y'all give up the goods like, we know that you don't have control of it because y'all been bullshitting for 8 months, 10 months now. Really? So anytime, that's why I love that commercial that Joe Biden has just recently released with him, with the dumbass in charge talking, and it's an oval from a voter, and you, how you black, how we're going to cancel him out is by voting him and his cronies out. That's why I was so empowered as I filled in my ballot and handed it in to make sure it counted. I'm tired of hearing these people that are marginalized that really think that this fool in charge means anything to them, that he is more divisive because it benefits Donald Trump and only Donald Trump. And that's just the way it is. For him anyways, we don't need that kind of lack of leadership. We have to survive because there's just so much more that we need to learn from each other and a life that is not really promised to us, but it would be great to be able to live it without being on a ventilator for months and then not surviving. That's why we have to vote. And we have to have an overhaul of this administration because these fools are just ridiculous. And who they are packing the Supreme Court with has me also given me heartburn, because they are willing to reverse every game that we have actually had just to push their conservative, right wing, ultra conservative, ultra racist agenda. It's not safe here. I was actually scared to, and I still am, that I'm actually scared to still be in this country if Trump wins. But I'm also scared to be here if he wins, I was scared I was going to leave. But I think if this fool loses, we're going to have a whole bunch of people that felt that nobody is paying attention to them. So they're going to act the fool just because their guy lost. And it's going to take us a number of years to be able to get back to some semblance of normalcy, because this corona shit is not over. We're on tap for this, just in this country alone, to kill more than the Spanish flu did in 1917. However, we have the technology. We could have prevented it. We had the same tools. Don't congregate and spread the shit. Wash your damn hands and wear masks. That's what they told us in 1917. It still applies to corona, but nobody wants to do it. They're saying crazy shit. This is a way to control people. Yeah, it's a way to control people that we don't get sick and die. I'm sorry. Or you get sick, survive, and you're worse off living because you're still short of breath, because, and you still have a stroke, and you still lost your legs. Or you still got to get a lung transplant because your lungs are now like popcorn and they don't work anymore. So with that said, if you can do anything, you need to vote, because our lives, everybody's lives depend on it. You wear a mask not just to protect yourself, but you also to protect everybody else. There's just so much dependent on this, and there's so much life that we all need to live. Watching the season change from my window. Yes, I'm sitting in judgment on my neighbors if you walking around wilding out and ain't wearing no mask. But if I get to see another day and enjoy the sun on my face, that is what I'm living for. What are you living for? And I'm not going to be able to do this unless we get this shit under control. And that's all I got to say about that. So vote is the bottom line. I wasn't sure how I was going to respond to this movie. I found out about it was it through the New York Times about a little over a week ago. So it's called The Queen's Gambit. It is about a story about a kid, Elizabeth, who was orphaned when her mother, Alice Harmon, dies in a motor vehicle accident in Kentucky. What tripped me out is the mother was brilliant. She was a professor, and she was running away from her own demons. It sounds like she's probably bipolar, and she had this kid. And it was supposed, the intent was supposed to be, and now towards the end of the movie, spoiler alert, it was a murder-suicide. She drove, it looks like she drove straight head-on into that oncoming semi-truck. And with the intention of killing her, not only herself, but her own kid. Elizabeth ends up in an orphan where she learns how to play chess from a kind of pervy, icky janitor. Didn't look like he touched her, but he did teach her a game that would... A game that would take her across the world. What killed me is they used to tranquilize these kids, illegally, of course, and she would play, she learned to play chess mostly in her head. What tripped me out more were several points. The error accuracy from the shark fin like Cadillac that she was driven around with in 1968 Russia to her, the authenticity of her chess moves. That's what one of the consultants on the show, who's a chess great himself, he basically said that this particular movie put chess at the forefront. Leave it up to Hollywood, Netflix, or whatever to make geeky chess cool, because it basically did make chess cool. She was buying chess magazines and chess books when other girls were talking about dating the Beatles. She was absolutely amazing. And it would kill me because everybody basically discounted her. How could some skinny white chick with red hair from Kentucky, of all places, come and kick every male, this male-dominated sport's ass? So, I'm digging it for its strength. I'm digging it because I think some of this is based in truth, although they basically said it's not, on just any single female chess player. But it just smacks of truth on so many realms. In the sudden death chess game, you know, she pauses and looks to the sky where she played chess in her head. And she wouldn't accept a draw. She wants to win. And it looks like it's possible. And it kills me because why won't the world just allow her to be great? She had all this crap that she actually had to overcome just to even get to this point, from the church, from her so-called friends. But what ends up being, I think, the moral of the story is that she would find out that she would not be able to win just by herself. She would have to fight these demons, and she would actually have to learn from the people, with the help of the people, her friends, other chess players that she would end up beating, men that she would end up sleeping with and breaking their hearts and their souls, I guess. But she was, this character was bad. And the bottom line is, her winning this chess championship is like winning the nerd Super Bowl. What would have been cool is if the black girl, Jolene, who called her Cracker, actually won and gone all loop, and it been kind of like a Josephine Baker, Orphan Makes Good kind of story. But I guess, I wonder if there are anyone like that. Maybe I just need to write that script. But she was an all-around rock star. Loved one cat, who she also kicked his ass in chess too. And she was an international star. How crazy is that? I was actually just astonished by the fashion about the fashion, and just the genuine details. A modern day Mary Tyler Moore with the red hair. How cool was this? And all she wants to do is get outside in Moscow to go probably play chess in the park with just regular people. But she'll never be just a regular person, because I think through her mom, who was a mathematics whiz, but she was crazy. Basically, she inherited that, the strategy and the calculations to be able to become a world-renowned chess player. How they presented chess, its glamour, and just about community was absolutely amazing. And how this little kid from Kentucky basically rolls up into Russia and beats some of the masters is absolutely amazing. But it also taught that we all have something to learn from each other and how important community is. It cracks me up. The ending scene, she meets all of these great chess players sitting at their card tables in some park in Russia. And how they are her biggest fans. How crazy is that? It is one of those stories that has, of course, a Hollywood spin on it. But that seems like it's okay. And this is how I'm going to end this session. It's a good watch. I'll give it multiple thumbs up. And I think the listening audience should basically take the time to binge watch it, or just watch it at your leisure, because it basically promotes an amazing story. That's the bottom line, as well as glamorizes being smart. When we are in a world now that makes fun of smart people, and you're basically have career-ending fights when everybody is against smartness and you're being penalized for being smart. This is actually one of those stories that celebrates it. And that's why I'm just so grateful that I actually got the opportunity to watch it. And I think everybody else, listening audience, should watch it. Check it out. The Queen's Gambit. It's a good watch. Thanks, Netflix, for bringing it to us. Oh, crap. Can you imagine? This is like one of the first weeks that I have not been able to add anything to my book review, to update my chatterbooks, because even the book review was unimpressive. Also, the reviews of the books that they were actually for kids with a horror and back with Halloween as a thing, because you know next week is Halloween. Yeah. I would never allow my kid to read any of that stuff, so I'm not going to add those Halloween-esque additions to chatterbooks. For definitely not part of the adult portion, and definitely not part of the kids version either. So this is what the Sunday business section of the New York Times has said about the Johnny Come Lately to the change in diversity game at Vogue. And I'm going to probably read to you this in its entirety because I thought it was well written. And I'm one of those people that I basically only buy Vogue maybe once every 5 or 10 years. Their September edition has become, it's like the playbook of playbooks of fashion. And from what I understand, I am not really all that drawn to that publication because I always believed that it was filled with a bunch of stuff that I could never afford. I don't recall ever reading I didn't even see the section or the write-up. Actually, it was two because Michelle Obama, I believe I did buy that edition because I thought it was just beautifully shot. And she's is such a icon already, and it basically her magnanimous spirit showed through on that issue. I'm not a full-out hardcore Beyonce stan, so I did not see her cover, and I didn't hear the shoot. I did, and I have purchased. Did I purchase his book? Yes, I think I actually purchased Andre Talley's book. I thought it was a bit vapid read, but it was well done because it had a lot of tea from him being an insider. It was always within years that everyone, especially in fashion, knows of the lack of diversity within the fashion world. So I found this magazine headed up by Anna Wintour and a whole bunch of white people. They can do what they want to do. You know, I mean, it's their magazine. They can represent who they want to represent. And now they seem to finally say, well, now it's okay to cash in on, I'm sure, that massive wealth of creativity representing another side. So here we go. This is an article by Edmund Lee in this morning's Sunday business section of the New York Times. Vogue September issue was different this year. Anna Wintour and her... wait a minute, it's October. That means... frack. I don't even think it's actually still on the newsstands because it is October. See, that's how late I am when it comes to this fashion. But anyways, at 316 pages, this issue, titled Hope, featured a majority of black artists, models, and photographers, a first for the magazines. For members of the Vogue editorial team, the September edition came in the uneasy wake of the internal email she had sent June 4th. I want to say plainly that I know Vogue has not found enough ways to elevate and give space to black editors, writers, photographers, designers, and other creators, she wrote. She was the editor-in-chief since 88, and she's been Condé Nast artistic director since 2013, making her the editorial leader of all its titles. We have made mistakes to publishing images or stories that have been hurtful or intolerant. I take full responsibility for these mistakes. Black editors who have worked with Ms. Wintour said they saw her apology as hypocritical, part of a calculated play by an executive known for her ability to gauge the public mood. Other black journalists who are current or former employees of Condé Nast said the email and the September issue that followed it represented an awkward, though heartfelt, attempt at genuine change. You know, but at least she's trying. I'm going to have to pick this up and I'll judge it for myself. At the recording of this episode, I've already come up with a part two. I'm not going to say, because I don't know any of these people, but I do know this venerable brand and magazine has been bereft of diversity probably since its inception. So kudos to her for at least trying. The Rare magazine editor, who is known outside the publishing industry, Miss Wintour, she's simply Anna to those in the know or those who want to be, has become a singular cultural figure. After establishing herself in fashion, media, and entertainment in the first part of a career that stretches to the 70s, she has more recently become a political power player for the Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. And as the orchestrator of the Met Art Costume Institute benefit, better known as the Met Gala, she has transformed an affair for Manhattan society set into full-blown East Coast Oscars, with luminaries from fashion, music, movies, and sports on the Anna Control guest list. So with that said, and there's pictures of her sitting next to, I think that's Serena, and then there is a moody picture of Andre Talley in the bushes, probably somewhere in North Carolina. Oh, and they have one of these things is hysterical. A colonial broad. For Miss Wintour, who descends from British nobility and was recently made a Dame Commander of the Order of the British Empire, the pace of the current movement protest may be a challenge, but she is also a daughter of a London newspaper editor and has made a career out of anticipating responding adroitly to cultural trends. Condé Nast. To work at Vogue is to inhabit a kind of prep school dormitory where relationships are defined by family ties and social connections that span generations. For many young people of color who come from less rarefied backgrounds, gaining a toehold was considerably more difficult. Condé Nast assistants famously put up with grueling hours and humiliating tasks, a job satirized in The Devil Wears Prada, one of my favorite movies. A best-selling novel by a former Wintour assistant and a later hit movie starring Meryl Streep as demanding boss. The hazing is seen as a rite of passage, part of why the company has the nickname Condé Nast. And while black staff members acknowledge all that, they said the race complicates matters. Black employees are often asked to participate or merely show up for high-level meetings, a corporate practice known as fronting. Six people interviewed for this article said, at Vogue, they have been asked to weigh in on cover images or take part in discussion with advertisers for them that do not typically call on junior employees. In a statement, Condé Nast and Vogue and all the leaders at our brands have made concerted efforts to build inclusion into all we do every day. In 2016, the actress Lupita Nyong'o was at Vogue office at One World Trade in Lower Manhattan to discuss a planned photo shoot. Ms. Nyong'o sat down with the top editors who had proposed photographing her home country, Kenya, along with some family members. The accompanying article would also focus on her family. Ms. Nyong'o expressed concern about how her family would be portrayed, saying she feared they might come across as cultural props. According to several people with knowledge of the meeting, after a long pause, a junior editor, the only black staff member in the room, piped up. Addressing the actress, she suggested that the shoot would be an opportunity to showcase Africa, a rarity in any American magazine, let alone Vogue. The shoot was a go, and the junior editor was never asked to attend a fashion meeting again. Wow. So, yeah, they are a prop. They are a prop, but it's like they are great accessories, people of color at this magazine, but you're not expected to participate in or be truly a part of what all of that means. You basically show up and keep your mouth shut. Don't make any waves, because if not, like, they basically silence this junior editor. You just basically disappear. I find that quite disheartening. And I can truly say for the entire reading of this week's papers, I'm completely and utterly just unimpressed by all that was the New York Times and the Times Free Press. I'm going to cruise through the LA Times. Maybe they actually have something more exciting going on the left coast. I'm hoping to find great stories and tales of survival, because it seems like the West as well as Colorado are on fire. So I'm looking for stories of hope, more so than what I got this week from the New York Times. So this week I took my last delivery from Blue Apron. Blue Apron is one of a series of food delivery services that specialize in shipping to amateur cooks and people that it's like a food prep service. It's like, if you can't have, not everyone in the world can have their own private chef, so you basically subscribe to these chef inspired services that teach you how to basically cook, hopefully as simple as possible, and prepare. Prepare the food. This week, I selected southern pork chops and crispy corn cakes with apple braised collard greens and a Mexican strip steak with jalapeno cilantro sauce. However, the pork and the beef are getting ready to go in to the freezer because of my purchase from Publix. I basically purchased 16-piece all dark fresh fried chicken from Publix, and that made a better pairing with actually both of the chili lime vegetables with toasted pepitos and the corn cakes with the collard greens. Well, it would have if I hadn't overcooked the collard greens. What I did find, though, is I don't understand why people find it necessary to mix up apple cider, and in this case, apples, with collard greens. Collard greens are collard greens, and it pairs better with something smoked. You can use turkey neck, but I prefer, as usual, some pork product. So that was a hit and miss. And grating apples is asking to send a sister to the ER, because, again, who has a box grater at their disposal? And why, again, are you trying to add apples to collard greens? That's stupid. And it's so Northeastern. I just don't understand y'all up there. You can't screw up collard greens. You need to just stop it. Take out the apple cider vinegar. Take out apples. It doesn't belong in a collard green. It just doesn't. But I was digging this roasted peppers and with roasted peppers with cauliflower topped with those little pepitos and the mint leaves. The mint leaves were a little bit bogus because it came a little bit, it looks like the coolness probably did something to oxidize the mint leaves. But I did get the essence of it, and I did like that as a garnish, and it was actually really good. So I'm probably going to continue making this cauliflower dish. It was just amazing, and I loved the cilantro sauce. That was the bomb. And I think what is really more telling is after I bought salt, fat, and acid in heat, it makes me think that, number one, there are a lot of great recipes within that book. But I think with a book like that, it gives you opportunity to look at going to the grocery store a little bit differently. Like, I still have fresh green beans that I'm going to probably braise and eat with either the chicken. Maybe I'll leave. So I won't put the pork chop. I'll put the pork chops in the freezer, but I'm going to leave the skirt steak out because I'm really interested in braising those with like garlic or something, the green beans, and then having the skirt steak, and I'll probably eat that tomorrow. And I do still have a little bit of the vegetables left because I really did like the roasted cauliflowers. I find that to be good. I'll probably eat the rest of those collard greens because I don't like food going to waste. And then tomorrow, I'll probably cut and soak the overnight the Cornish hens that I did buy in buttermilk to make some really good roast turkey with a Japanese-inspired sauce for my Chinese cabbage that I bought from North Carolina. I'm looking forward to that. I think that's going to be really good. Nice light meal. I'll probably pair up with the Sauvignon, the Josh Sellers Sauvignon Blanc that I opened up. That actually would go really good with that. But if I have some of that left. But I do have a Four Cellars cab that I think will also pair really well with skirt steak that I'm going to have tomorrow too. So the end part of this is I'm a kind of a daring person as far as food. And I'll try anything. That's why I did try the apples and collard greens. And I can truly say that, again, apple cider vinegar and apples should not be in collards. But I don't think that I want to continue with this food service because it doesn't make any sense. I'm going to be just as daring by suggestions of the chef Salmon Nose Rat. And there are so many great restaurants locally here in Chattanooga and the surrounding areas that will make a unrepentant foodie like myself experience all of these things and experience really great things. I'm excited about the journey that I'm going to be going on in the upcoming months, and I'll let you guys in on a little bit of it as I experience all of the good eats that await me in my adventure as I discover and eat my way through many delicacies and countries. Since I can't travel there, I can experience these great things through my mouth and through great food. So I hope you'll join me as I go through these things. It's more than just pork barbecue. It's going to be textures and taste. I don't feel like cooking it. And I know there's a whole bunch of great people that will do better than me. So there you go. One of the things that I find endearing about my new home state is and I'm going to start saying that more often. I'm going to have to practice it though, y'all. Is the heritage in fine bourbon making and fine whiskey making. Everyone knows about Jack Daniel's, but what they did not know, and it had been suppressed or hidden for many years, is the slave Nearest Green's contribution to that venerable centuries-old brand. That he actually, in his hard work, actually helped to make famous. Not even a near relative of this brand, but also an African-American distiller, which is rare and female at that, made that brand into the premium brand it is. So So when I keep seeing, and it's actually in the front of Riverview shops, a Kentucky bourbon, Basil Hayden's, And I was kind of, because I've had this hate relationship with the state of Kentucky. I've been kind of boycotting anything from that venerable state for since my sham of a job at the beginning of last year with a company that shall remain nameless. But it's crazy because it was through that experience that I actually started this podcast. So go figure. So what I'm going to add to this particular section is why I had to get over myself and to want to compare these two bourbons. And the reason I bring it up is because they had a full ad this week in the New York Times magazine. How cool is that? So I needed to do some more investigation on this distillery to see if they were up to the task. So this is where we're going to go from here. We're going to just visit, in my mind anyways, this particular distillery. So join me. So the bourbon itself, they say it's artfully aged to taste. It has a spicy, sweet flavor profile. On their website, they have the recipes for old school Manhattans and old fashions. Oh, I love this glass. It is... You know what? They really make you jump through hoops. I wonder who are these people? Where are they located? About us? Home? Our whiskeys? Where is this located? Where is Basil Hayden's located? Claremont. Huh. Can you visit? Yeah. Expensive. It's smooth. It's so locally, so that's actually really good. Oh, they tripping. This is a subsidiary of Jim Beam. And it looks like Jim Beam, they got bought out a couple of years ago, was it, by some Asian conglomerate. So I don't know if I actually still trust them. But that makes sense. Okay. All the Beams. Isn't that crazy? And Basil Hayden is one of them. This is all Whiskey University. That's actually good to know. It's actually made in the heart of Bourbon Country up in Kentucky. But most of the distillery is owned by foreign people. So good luck with that. But I'm wondering if it is, in fact, smoother than Uncle Nearest and even Jack Daniels. I don't know. But I don't know if I still continue to boycott it just because I'm cranky like that. But anyways, it's a good try. I would still go with Uncle Nearest before I would actually buy this brand. And I would continue to stand for Tennessee whiskeys more so than the Kentucky any time of the day. Tennessee's been good for me. And also that their whiskey is the bomb and everybody should drink that, probably above the Kentucky whiskeys at this time. Smoother, with a kick. I'm just saying. But then again, I'm biased because I live here now. So go figure. So join me as for this next session because it's becoming a work of love. I'm hopeful that this house doesn't sell because I absolutely love it. I can only imagine myself playing video games there as I look over the rest out towards the rest of Chattanooga. And I even record this podcast in this very building. So join me as I salivate and fall even more in love with this house on Mission Ridge. 2020 has sucked on so many different levels. It has been the culmination of a four-year shit show of a reality TV show, the worst on the planet. COVID-19 has kicked our ass, and she ain't finished yet. And I am still so blessed in spite of the negativity. One of the things that I've been blessed about is just how I've been given the time to dream. This past summer has been challenging because, in all reality, I listed my main house that I had lived in on and off for 20 years just to see what I could be offered and if I could get a fast closing. So I listed it with the service, got an offer the same day with a 2-week close, completely unheard of. And then because nobody is going to offer that kind, I guess they don't trust them enough. No one was going to do the same thing in Lumberton, but I was able to get connected with a real estate agent that within 24 hours of listing the house, that house that I purchased in 2004, I accepted an offer on that house the next day. It was below asking price, but I was so glad about a 45 day close that I was ecstatic. Moving is very, it can be very disheartening and disruptive, but I was able to pack it all up, put it in storage, and get back to Chattanooga where I want it to be anyways. I have not been able to purchase what I initially wanted because I couldn't work out the financing because of my own shenanigans. In 2016 through 2018, I was wilding. But I'm glad I didn't get stuck in that purchase because I would not have found this property. Mission Ridge is one of those places here in the county that is absolutely amazing. Zero leaks and zero feel is possible. It is a area that is completely affluent, but it's also the site of where the Union Army basically beat the crap out of the Confederate Army. It's hysterical that this is where they beat down good old crazy ass Braxton Bragg of Fort Bragg, where I got my beginnings as far as a professional physician. And it cracks me up that this is where they beat his schizophrenic ass down. So as I was giving the double middle finger to North Carolina, it is great that I fell in love with this property that he actually got beat down at. So I find that amazing. But it's also a place where if I wanted to make my stand as a single African-American cisgendered female, I can piss off a whole bunch of Confederate ghosts and a whole bunch of living affluent white folks that don't think I should have it. And it may be that I won't be able to purchase the property, that someone will see how beautiful this property is and they'll take it over. But at least I can dream. And that's one of the positive things about this time. You could be depressed and angry, but I'm thankful that I have the opportunity to dream. And I know you shouldn't fall in love with the thing, but this house on Crest Road is actually a dream that I want to come true. And it wasn't just so long ago that I wouldn't have thought that I would be worthy to dream of something on this grand of a scale. The house is from, it's not rumored, I honestly think it is one of the Sears and Roebuck turn of the century kit houses. It looks like exactly like the Magnolia plan. This house, you could actually buy it for about $7,000 and it would be shipped to you in like 40,000 pieces. It's 1912, and I'm thinking it's one of the few of these particular structures that are still that is still standing. The structure of the house, it has great bones, but the way the layout is a little bit weird. I'm hopeful that the more I look at the pictures, I'm hopeful that they have it has not been stripped of the details that would make it worth 110-year-old house. Although I think the floor plan needs some work, it would be interesting to look for a crew right here in Tennessee that could allow me to and give me a good estimate on how much, not only should I pay for it, because I have an idea about how much it should be offered for, but also how much is it going to, I would need to actually put into it to bring it up to not only restore its former glory, but also to bring it up to today's standard to make it the million-dollar palace that it should really be. I don't think, from what I can see on the outside, it's not listed on the historical registry, but I'm also thinking about doing that. And I think this is where I would make my stand. If I'm going to not move again, and if I'm going to make this my forever home, I think I need to put in the work. I need to put in the money and just make it a potential dream house. I've actually lived in a new construction. When I had that house built in North Carolina, now I know what I don't want. And if you're going to go historic and, number one, inherit the historic headaches, this house would seem to be just worth it. Unless there, we could start from the outside. Unless there's some egregious, dangerous architectural deficits, I would keep it as is. I would need to make sure that the foundation is secure. I would need to make sure that if there are any chimneys or any fascia, that roof, all of that would need to be secure. I think the shrubbery would need to be probably redone and just to give it some curb appeal. If was worth, if I couldn't get a herb garden, I may want to consider getting a coated greenhouse because with some hydroponics, because I think our time dependent on expensive food, it's going to be just outrageous in the upcoming years. And I'm with the farm to table. I'm also with supplying my own food just in case some, you know, something pops off. I also saw on the Property Brothers, where they used the container. And they dropped in a basically a container created pool. I think this, if it has the room, this house and the addition, which is also very cool. There's an additional guest house on the property. The additional guest house needs to be made into converted into a pool house or like a cabana situation. And then I do need a pool. And also maybe let's just also stop right there. Putting in a truly outside, indoors, outside, inside space, turning that into not that guest house. I don't know about the rules for Airbnbs, but I don't think I want anybody back there. But making that into a potential artist studio, office, steam room, and workout space. That is where I would actually do a lot of work on. And that actually, to me, is also very cool. Going into the inside of the house, the way it goes, like you go into the front door, there's a portico where I could park my truck. And potentially by next year, I would actually have an electric vehicle that they're going to be making right here in Chattanooga from Volkswagen. But what I also could see is up changing the situation where and making it more of an open concept. Right now, it goes from like a parlor room, living room space to butler's pantry to a recently updated kitchen. And then it goes to like another living room area, I believe. I don't think, but there's a whole bunch of walls in the way. And then the back part of the house is like this really elongated, closed-in sunroom. How can you have a sunroom without, with only two, three windows? That doesn't make any sense to me. So that whole side of the place probably needs to be reconfigured, I would think. Bringing in, potentially reconfiguring the kitchen with the addition to make sure it's gas with a Wolf updraft, and also a couple of Euro cave for wine. I'm not sure what to think about that butler's pantry, or just swinging it around as a prep area or as a dry bar. It would be actually nice, but just not where it is right now. And opening up that whole area and taking down and reconfiguring some of the walls where the kitchen, the enlarging the kitchen to maybe be an eat-in kitchen with a formal dining area kitchen and then a family slash living room. And one of the other living areas can also be changed to a formal library. I think it does have the space to build in or have some, I'm sure there has to be a salvage place where I could actually salvage some built-in mahogany or some type of exotic wood to turn it into a formal living areas, hot pocket doors, the whole nine, custom trick it out. The upstairs, it looks like the entranceway is pretty grand. The entranceway lighting needs to be changed, but the stairs themselves are beautiful. It goes onto this landing, which I wouldn't really change at all. But I don't know exactly where the master is. And depending on which window has the best views, it can be definitely converted into a master suite. And again, I saw this also on Property Brothers, where the entranceway to the master is also like a library and reading nook. When you go into the master suite, beams would be out of place in this Italianate or Tuscan revival type floor outside. That would make a whole bunch of sense. But wherever there is also a deck that I think, if we could actually take advantage of the deck making that off of the master suite or access to the deck, and also increasing the windows so you can also enjoy the views of Mission Ridge. And just general updates to the bathrooms themselves. If there are is carpet anywhere in the house, making sure, seeing if there is actually the original hardwood floors, and replacing it if necessary, preferably with reclaimed wood instead of some of this engineered crap. And then putting down kind of Persian rugs if I need to. Also making sure, I'm wondering, because I didn't pull any permits, but I'm not sure, but there was no records of any permit work done on the plumbing and the electrical. That's actually concerning because of the age of the house. If I'm going to be taking out walls anyways, I may want to see, one, is the house grounded, and then two, replacing the electrical system, which could run into the tens of thousands of dollars. So, and I'm also very concerned with cast iron lines as well as plumbing, and that would probably be another very expensive upgrade because, again, there were no records or permits that I could actually find online. And also making sure, if I want that pool and steam room and sauna, making sure all of that is permitted, but also making sure that the sewer system, either existing or how much it would cost for an upgrade. And if you're talking about this much of a remodel, looking to someone that could keep costs down by making good choices. So this 110-year-old house could last for another century, but I'm not trying to spend $1 million to get it where it needs to be. Doing it once, cutting, measuring 50 times and cutting once, and being able to do it all within about 6 months is going to be key. And I think it's going to be doable. But I'm going to also spend the time in the next several months coming up with an itemized needs to be able to verbalize my wants and considerations, and then getting truly a line item estimate about the changes that I actually want. This is only a very, I believe, a very surface review about how I would like to proceed with the project of this caliber. I think starting right there and knowing the big job that's ahead and picking someone that can actually run it would be amazing. So the next would be about shoring down what I want, coming up with a line item wish list, and getting estimates on those, the cost and materials. And then picking the right company, finances, and because I don't think that I should try to roll a new mortgage on the house, loan on the house, with a construction loan. I'm actually truly considering financing both of them separately. I honestly think, and coming up with those costs is going to be actually key in making it as accurate as possible. Because, and who knew this, that I would dare dream of a potential for $1 million price tag loan, a series of loans to be able to finance this. The house is currently listed at $695. They bought it in, this last purchase was in 2014, and they paid $675. I don't think I would offer $6.95. I would like to come in at $6.85. I'm wondering also if I could keep the cost of the renovations down to a cool $400-$450. But I'm thinking it's going to run anywhere between $500 and $600. But I'm just wondering if I'm just overshooting about all that I would like to do in a, on a property like that. And who thought a kid from Aragona Village and Reedstown, Virginia Beach would be or would allow herself to dream so big? That's what COVID has done for me. It's allowed me to dream and to think through things. And I'm blessed to be able to do it. So that's where I'm going to end this episode of Tennessee Fro was reading. I've got, I believe, a lot accomplished in this episode. I've talked heartily about what it means to vote and getting the vote out, as well as what I'm eating and drinking and research. And if you like what you have heard and you have other suggestions of what I should be adding to Chatterbook, my online bookstore, please drop me a line at TennesseeFro@gmail.com. If your comments are not too trolly, or if you have some good suggestions, I'll give you a shout out on the next show. I think that would actually be pretty awesome. And you can use my hashtag, TennesseeFroGotJokes, if you really know someone that needs to send, you need to ship a bag of dicks to, or TennesseeFro is reading, that's the hashtag or the promo code that you can actually use for my, to get a percentage off if you want, to get a percentage off at writersblock coffee. And again, I hope you will join me in my next iteration of the show upcoming next week. And if you would just navigate also over to my Over 40 and Unapologetically Nerdy as I chat premium content about Star Trek Discovery, as well as my own fictional podcast, Survivor Mode, I think you'll enjoy it. And again, let me know what you think. If you're not too trolly, I'll actually read it online. And that's where I'm going to leave this episode. I hope you guys have a great week. Bye.